Item 7, consider and take possible action to implement the recommended investment benchmark structure. Good morning. Been a long morning. Welcome.
I think I just messed this up, like I always do every time I come in front of you. Is this on?
No, red is on.
Red is on, green is not. Yep, there you go.
Excellent. So, nice to see you all. It's been a bit of a long morning. I hope you guys are saving some brain cells for this one. I want to first introduce my colleague who is joining me from our Seattle office, Danny Sullivan, headed up our risk team for many years, and he's transitioning to the consulting side. And Danny was instrumental in conducting the complex analysis that we're bringing for you today. Fortunately, the results of the analysis are pretty straightforward, and so I'm going to go through that and talk to you about a recommendation that we have coming out of this. So let's talk about session objectives. Thank you. So really what we're trying to do here today is make sure that you guys have the tools and the information as fiduciaries to help you make the difficult decisions that you need to make. A large part of that is looking at investment performance, comparing it to a good high quality benchmark to give you good performance information that leads you to understand what's going on in the portfolio. Part of what we have encountered in the past is challenges with the benchmark. It really started, you know, we kind of identified it in 2020, watched it, did some analysis and it continued to be sort of problematic, did some analysis in 2021, made some adjustments. They helped, but didn't really solve the problem, did some more analysis in 2022, made some more adjustments. The issues continued. And so this is, sort of the definitive work that we've done to hopefully bring this issue to a conclusion so that the performance that we're showing you really highlights the areas where your staff and where we can go in and say, okay, here's what we understand is happening. Here are the things that we really need to look at to make potential improvements to the portfolio. So it's taking out those challenges with the benchmark that we've been working at and really had trouble fixing for quite some time. We're bringing you what we think is a definitive solution here today. So as part of today, I'm going to review the historical efforts, going to explain those challenges, understand where the problems in benchmarking are coming from, and that's the analysis that Danny did that is pretty enlightening, and then provide a recommendation on how to fix that. Going into background a little bit, So why are we here? Well, we're here because of those red numbers across the bottom, right? So, you know, we were cruising along after we put in FFP. We were getting outperformance and underperformance, and that's what you expect. We thought we had a pretty good understanding of where that outperformance and underperformance was coming from. Until the underperformance really wasn't fully explained by the things that we look at, which is, you know, what's your allocation relative to policy and how are your active managers doing relative to their benchmarks primarily. What we discovered there was that your private markets and how we were benchmarking that was causing some white noise, some noise in some some useless tracking error in those benchmark numbers, those benchmarks comparisons. So we did that in 2021, and I'll show you in a minute, that sort of fixed it, right? We were right in looking backwards, but going forwards, you can see those numbers in 21, 22, year-to-date 23 up through 930. There were still problems that existed. As I turn the page, you can see how, you know, looking backwards from that 2021 point, That fixed it, right? So this is expressing those numbers to that adjusted benchmark where we neutralized the private market's performance relative to the benchmark. And we still had that those red numbers going forward. You may recall in 2022, we brought to you a big analysis that showed some areas where, there were some issues in the portfolio, some active management issues, some issues with the overlay that were causing some underperformance over time. You know, all good stuff, all good information, but there was still that private markets challenge, and that was all due to when we changed and the fact that 2000 and 2021, we changed it going forward, but we didn't change it retrospectively, so we made an adjustment then, right? We just used that adjusted benchmark. And we put that back through time. And that fixed an element of it too, but the problems continue. So what we're doing now is we're really diving in on all the different components of where that change between the actual returns and the benchmark return exists. And that's the analysis that Danny did, and that's what we're gonna jump into now. So that's a little bit of history to bring you up to speed of what we've done and where we are. I'll just pause there to see if there are any questions so far. Okay, moving right along then. So moving into the analysis, there's an explanation that exists here, that is required here.
Should we move forward?
Yeah, thanks. There's an explanation that is required here, and I'm going to go into this a little bit. Stop me if you need further explanation. I think the way I describe it is pretty straightforward, right? You start with the policy allocation. That's what staff and we come to you and recommend through strategic asset allocation reviews annually, every 3 to 5 years, big asset liability studies that we're going to undertake this year. That's where you get your long-term strategic allocation. Annually, you adjust that in your board resolution to get you closer and closer to that long-term strategic allocation. That is your policy allocation, right? Arguably the most important decision that you guys make. So then
move through our fast.
We measure that against a benchmark. And there's three different sources of those returns, of your actual return and your benchmark return. Those three different sources are how are the weights to the asset classes relative to your strategic allocation, right? Let's just say simply you're a 60-40 portfolio. If you have 50% in equity instead of 60%, there's going to be some variability there for sure, right? So it's the weights and how you implement the weights relative to your strategic allocation. Also, your active managers, right? So that's the allocation effect. Also, your active managers, that's the selection effect. How are your active managers doing relative to their benchmarks? And you can see that in the reports that we bring. We show every manager relative to their benchmark, underperforming, outperforming over time. And that's another source of difference at the total fund level, how your active managers do. And then the third one, and this is the one that, you know, we've gotten a little bit of a handle on with the private markets, and we adjusted that, but there is a benchmark mismatch that doesn't provide you with any value. And that can be how your strategy is implemented at the manager level and the benchmarks they use relative to the benchmarks that you use at the total fund level, right? And that's what we're going to address today. So the allocation effect, how you're allocated relative to your strategic asset allocation in the policy, how your managers are doing relative to their benchmarks, and how those benchmarks are different than your total fund benchmark. Now, let me just give you a very simple and sort of extreme example. Let's say your policy benchmark is all country world index for equities, right? It's just the broad global opportunity set around the world. And the implementation is U.S. small cap equity. You can see, and that's how your manager is implementing it, and that's how you're measuring your manager. You can see how that difference at the manager level, at the implementation level, would cause big differences than your relative to your policy index. So that's an extreme example. Global equities at the policy, small cap domestic equities implemented. That is sort of the problem. It's not that extreme in the portfolio, but we'll show the impact there. So to measure that, and here's sort of where the challenge comes in. To measure that, we've got to add two, and this is a sort of a tried and true methodology that's established and used, you know, across large sophisticated funds in our country and elsewhere. To measure that, we need to create two additional benchmarks. We need to create, and this is just for analytical purposes, we need to create the policy index no benchmark mismatch. So if you think about that, right, you're making the policy index at the top level the same as the implemented index at the manager level. So instead of, in my extreme example, instead of using all country world index, we'd use that small cap domestic benchmark, right? And so that highlights where those differences are between your return, your policy, and your index return. And then the second one that we need to create and analyze is this passive portfolio benchmark, and that uses the manager benchmarks at the manager weights, right? So then that will show the difference from your total fund to your policy index to benchmark mismatch to manager returns at manager weight. So we're just sort of breaking up that delta into its component parts to say, oh, okay, well, there's a problem, and we can tweak that or fix that. And so you can see on the bottom of this page, it shows all the different benchmarks, all the different levels that we can go to show the difference. And then I'm going to reorder these, or Danny reordered these, and so you can see, you can really get to the individual components in a building block approach as they add to one another to highlight what's going on. So just to do a quick explanation on this page, this is the setup for the big reveal on the next page. So you start with the policy index, so that's the adjusted policy index that we have going back through the years now that took out that private markets problem that we had, and that measures the return of the policy allocation, the strategic asset allocation. Essentially, you know, what your investment policy does. And then we add in the no benchmark mismatch, and we subtract the one from the other, and this measures the white noise that you have from measuring the total fund differently than you've implemented the fund. And then you have that passive benchmark, and so subtracting the policy index from that leaves you with the value add from manager weights deviating from the target weights. And so this shows you where you've your over and underweights relative to target have added or detracted value. Those over and underweights could come from staff making slight tactical tilts. It could come from just natural drift. And it shows you, you know, what your moves relative to your policy weights provide. And then we have this this total fund minus the overlay. Right, you have an overlay program in your implementation. So it shows what the value added is there, and then you finally subtract out the total fund, and that is the D minus C is value add from active management. Right, so I skipped that piece right there. That's where your manager piece is, and we're going to see where there's a big component there. And then finally, E minus D, your total fund minus your overlay and cash, that shows you what that overlay program has done. So all the different components, one by one, stacked on top of each other. On the next page, really show you kind of where all this is leading. So I will point out that this is where Danny sort of becomes the hero, and I've got him here to answer the tough questions when Jay comes up with them. And so I make a joke because Jay and Danny worked together on risk previously. So the difficulty came in that you guys have a different different strategic asset allocation every year. because of those board resolutions that you do once a year following the strategic asset allocation review. And so Danny needed to actually input every single one of those going back through time to reevaluate the, you know, that building block approach every year. And so that's what you see on table 12 is this is consistent with those board resolutions that you implemented each year. So some numbers jump out at you on this page, right? So first of all, you can see value add from benchmark mismatch. Well, there's quite a bit there. If you look back at the 3 years, there's sort of useless information that's embedded in that comparison from your total fund return to your policy index due to benchmark mismatch. And that's because, you know, you've got, let's just call it at the equity level, you've got the Russell 3000 domestic equity, which is, you know, broadly reflective of the opportunity set, but you implement with a large cap value manager, large cap growth manager, small cap growth and value, and those weights are not identical to the Russell 3000, right? So there's a fair amount of mismatch there. Same thing on the international side, right? You have, we use Aquiex US, and you've got developed, and you've got emerging markets, both growth and value. And so the benchmarks that you use to implement are different than the total fund benchmark. There's also some issues with some difficult to benchmark things, similar to the way we had difficulty benchmarking private markets. We've got some alternative managers in there, and we've got a risk parity manager in there that we're benchmarking against a 60-40 portfolio. You know, there's going to be some noise in there, but I think that noise is acceptable. There will still be a little benchmark mismatch, but you know, we want to minimize that B minus A as much as possible. That's where we're going to end up on this with a recommendation to do that. So C minus B, passive benchmark, less no mismatch benchmark, that gives you value add from tactical asset allocation, portfolio drift. There's an element in your portfolio where the liquidity sleeve is fully funded to up to its target allocation at the beginning of the year and then slowly draws down, which you know, in a risk-on environment, that would help you over time a little bit. So those things are all embedded in there, but you can see that Tim and his team are doing a good job with tactical asset allocation to the tune of 1.2% over the last 3 years. So positive there, which is offset by detracted value in the next layer of active management. And this active management, so a large part of that is that risk parity that I talked about, comparing it to 60-40. They've underperformed significantly over time. There have been some adjustments to investment managers that your staff has made over time. We pointed out the last time we did this that your international managers were having some trouble over time. We're now looking at your emerging markets manager. And so there's some things embedded in there that say, okay, well, we need to take a look at this. And your staff is looking at this and will continue to look at it to see if there are improvements and adjustments that can be made there. And then the overlay, this was a bit of a surprise to me and begs a question that we'll look into with staff, and that is overlay seems to be detracting value over the last 3 years. And, you know, it's supposed to be pretty consistent value add. So all this is really good and valuable information, much of which we knew about and are already addressing. The thing that we didn't have a good handle on and want to adjust is that value add from benchmark mismatch. And just take that out of the equation so that the other things are the things that we're paying attention to, right? On slide 13, these observations are the ones that I just sort of highlighted, which brings us to please.
I had a question on page 13, Scott. As I was wading through this all by myself, I had to read several pages over and over again, and I was glazing over.
Yeah, but I appreciate that.
You
need me.
I'm sure Jay was sitting on the edge of his seat, but I wasn't. But the third observation just jumped out at me as kind of an aha moment. that calls into question, to me, it looks like the biggest argument to move or consider movement to far more passive than active management. Active management is clearly detracting considerably over a three-year period, 180 points, basis points. And so then I thought that just popped as an aha moment. This is an argument for, you know, more passive management or consideration of passive management and less for active. Am
Super
I reading
fair
that
question.
Wrong?
Super fair question.
Okay.
Yeah. And that is a big part of the considerations that Tim and I constantly talk about. And looking at those individual act. So it is a statement that could lead one to say, yeah, let's get out of active, right? But there's a lot of different components underneath that need to be looked at individually, which we're doing on a regular basis, and having the conversation, you know, can we pick good managers over the long period of time to get that excess return? So it's a constant consideration. Also, keep in mind that 3 years is a relatively short period of time. There's endpoint bias there. You have had periods in the past where your active managers have done well for you. So great question. I mean, you nailed it, and it is a big question.
Okay.
Now, Tim, do you want to add anything to that?
I would just add that this analysis allows us to do that deeper dive to say, like, okay, we were looking at things in aggregate before where we saw that 120 basis points of added value combined with that 180 basis points of negative value, and it was a little squishy. So going down this route, clearly delineate that, and like, okay, that leads us to the question, is this widespread? Is this a particular manager, a particular asset class? Is this a period where active management was not rewarded, but we believe in it long-term? This is the tool that allows you to ask the next layer of questions. So I don't know if we have answered those questions yet, but going down this path allows us to ask the next layer of questions in a little bit more structured and cogent way. So that would be kind of cue it up for more to come on that. And that obviously is the thing, you are correct, that's what jumps out at you in this analysis. And like, okay, was there something unique about this three-year period that we need to be cognizant of? It was COVID, it was the central bank lowering rates. Okay, did that overwhelm active management, or the manager simply lagging in spaces, and we need to address that on an individual basis? So we don't know that we have an answer to that today, but that's queued up for the next piece.
I was just picturing the next SACRS meetings where the whole back of the room is filled with associate members of SACRS, all of whom are active managers. And they're all, if they ever see this, they're going to all grab for their hearts at the same time.
I don't think it's any secret to active managers that they've been underperforming for a period of time.
Yeah, you guys are not alone.
This is, you had narrow leadership, particularly in the United States. The central bank has overwhelmed a lot of the idiosyncrasies. Zero interest rate policy for an extended period of time tends to make people make some interesting decisions about capital deployment.
Yeah.
And so you have a very unique environment. The problem is all environments are starting to feel like unique environments these days. So I think it's a fair point that you're making. More to come on that front.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. So, you know, interestingly, this is all about the benchmark mismatch and that that white noise that we're trying to get rid of. But the analysis did, to Jerry and Tim's point, pull out some other things to look at, which, you know, we weren't ignorant to for sure, but this really highlights them. So then on the next slide, this is the recommendation. And the recommendation is simply to implement the no mismatch benchmark policy to take that white noise out of there. And you can see the differences from the current policy to the recommended, current policy index to the recommended policy index. There's a bit of a typo in there on the Russell 3000 on that first blue column, current policy index. That should be 16 and not 10. And you can see the sections in the current policy index to the new recommended policy, those percentages should all add up and tie out. So if you look at the Russell 3000 at 16%, we break that out now into how it's actually implemented, right? And that'll take away that benchmark mismatch aspect. Same thing for international 12%, the broad MSCI ACWI-XU index. Well, you guys actually implement it with developed growth, developed value, EM growth, EM value, that behave differently than that broad ACWI-XU index at the top level. So, and we want to do that all the way down the portfolio. There are certain things in here that won't change, but the big levers that cause the big sort of useless tracking error, we want to change and make sure that the policy tracks.
So that I understand what's actually before us in terms of the recommendation, is the proposed action what is reflected on page 14?
Yes.
In the table, and is this a specific action versus some other type of change where this takes on a life of its own and that adjustments are made beyond what we see on this page?
Yes. So, so let me explain that a little bit better, right? So you have your board resolutions that change things every year. So, and every year we come to you and we say, here's the benchmark that we think goes with this resolution. The last one was the current policy index. So for that period, so we want to change to the board resolution policy index that matches the implementation weights. And we want to restate that policy index back to essentially when you started FFP and back to those board resolutions, when those board resolutions started. Right, to make sure that looking now and forward and back historically, you take that benchmark mismatch out of your performance comparison.
Okay, so I'm just trying to understand what the proposed action is in terms of being, this is super important, and yeah. We have to be very clear on the action. I mean, I can look at page 14 and see the specific action in today's terms, in a very static sense. I can look at all these changes and say, yep, get it, understand it.
Yeah.
Look at all these sub-indices and say, these are the correct match. But what I hear you saying, and I want to be sure that for purposes of a motion we embrace, is that this recommended benchmark structure is as, for the current period, is as shown on page 14, but in addition, that this it would amend and restate the board resolutions for the policy index in policy indices to match the implementation weights.
Yeah, and
each of those classes.
I put some high level language that you may or may not use as a board motion or a motion on slide 15. So it's essentially approving that recommended structure retroactively back through the beginning of the board resolution introduction.
Yeah, and I saw that, and I'm feeling like it might be a little high level in the sense of okay. Understanding
exactly what
6 months from now or 12 months from now what it is we did today. So I want to be sure that that's why I'm belaboring this point. Yeah. I want to be sure that we understand that the proposal before us and the change we would make were we to adopt it is actually to become an annualized exercise with respect to the asset classes that we have by type and class that are shown on page 14,
right?
And that we're going to do that each year.
Yep, as you do now.
And then we're going, but the other part of this is to retroactively amend and restate all of the prior years.
Yep.
In the same manner and in the same fashion, right?
Yes.
Is that fair? Okay.
That is the recommendation.
Right. Maybe that was obvious to everybody else. It wasn't crystal clear to me, so I just want to be sure because 12 months from now, we may not remember what we did.
Tim? I think just to clarify what the proposal is to adopt a methodology and use that methodology since the inception of FFP, and the methodology is you're using a roll-up of the board's annual asset allocation resolutions to create the total fund benchmark. That's the no mismatch benchmark.
Thank you.
Making sure I stated that correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, there we go. And so it's a little bit of that philosophical change.
Okay.
It makes sense to do this and not to assume that some of these things are going to be evergreen and once you decide to do it. I just want to avoid the potential conclusion someone draws that it's sort of like shooting arrows and then going out and drawing the targets.
Yeah, that's a concern.
So that it matches better. So I'd like to avoid that. Possibly that conclusion that someone would draw.
There are periods, and it showed here where this will not be a favorable comparison. There was one year where it was off, you know, that went against. It's favorable overall, but there are periods where it's not favorable, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Karen, you had your hand up.
Thank you. Yes, I have some questions in trying to understand this recommendation on page 14 and also trying to understand the retroactive impact of a change. Can you explain, Scott, in more detail the differences between the current policy index column and the recommended? For example, you have for domestic equity Russell 3000 at 10, which is 16%, I think you said. And your recommendation is to split it up into subgroups. And you're recommending Russell 1000, Russell 1000, Russell 2000, Russell 2000 growth and value. So can you explain the difference between the two?
You bet.
It seems like when the board adopted the new asset allocation, we attached a goal for each, and that's in current policy index, right? And now looking back at it, we're thinking there was a mismatch, and we'd like to change that goal, modify it in the way you're proposing, and you're recommending that we do that retroactively. So our entire performance will be measured differently retroactively. Can you explain kind of the details behind that?
Yeah. So, okay. So thanks for the question. So the Russell 3000 is the 3,000 largest stocks in the U.S. It's essentially, you know, practically speaking, it is the domestic opportunity set, U.S. equity opportunity set. So the way that benchmark is broken down by Russell is you can show it in different components, and it is made up of the Russell 1000, which is the largest, you know, large cap, largest stocks in the Russell 3000, and the Russell 2000, which is small cap, the smallest stocks, right? So if you take the Russell 1000 or the Russell 2000, logically, it aggregates to the Russell 3000. Then you can take the Russell 1000 and you can break it into different types of stocks, growth stocks and value stocks. And so if you take the Russell 1000 growth and the Russell 1000 value, it aggregates up to the Russell 3000. And so the ones on the right essentially aggregate up to the one on the left. The difference is the weights. In the Russell 3000, there is more large cap than you are implementing. There's more Russell 1000 than you are implementing in the portfolio. You have an overweight to small cap. And so what this does is it reflects that overweight, that implementation overweight to small cap relative to the Russell 3000. So, and that's where that benchmark mismatch comes from, and that's what we're trying to eliminate. And you have the same issue in international, right? MSCI ACWI XUS is made up of developed stocks, or MSCI All Country World, and emerging market stocks. So it's a similar situation where the components on the right add up to the benchmark on the left. It's just how those percentages for each of the components are implemented in the portfolio, which is what causes the benchmark mismatch, which again is what we're trying to eliminate. So does that make sense?
Yeah, so if I understand you correctly, the two columns are actually equal in the aggregate, but the recommended column is a further breakdown in some cases.
Correct. To more closely match the implementation of the Contra Costa portfolio.
Yeah, implementation, but it's not as though the components on the right-hand column equal the left-hand column there. It reflects kind of the factor tilts that you have in your existing manager lineup. And that's kind of my question here is that, right, those were choices you guys undertook, staff undertook, to implement either the overweighting of small cap or value of growth tilt or, you know, that implementation or what's labeled component B. And I'm sorry, to fix a benchmark issue, you had to add three more benchmarks, but component B is just like component D, those are choices, right?
Those, that's a great point. So those are actually what the board adopts in, you know, flowing from the asset allocation study to the asset allocation resolution. So that is a reflection of what the board has adopted in terms of the emerging market weight, the small cap weight. So historically, those have been aggregated up into bigger ones that, you know, kind of look like what we did, but not quite. And since that was a board decision, we want to embed that into the asset allocation. So the decision to overweight and underweight relative to those targets that are in the asset allocation, that's not what we're talking about here. So the board adopts a 1.5% target to small cap manager XYZ. That's what we want to kind of reflect in the benchmark here. So it's that board adoption of the asset allocation and the resolution. So that resolution would be reflected in this new benchmark.
Okay, so it's because the board adopts, you know, at that level, you want those board decisions reflected in the benchmark,
yeah,
and so that's your argument for making it retroactive as well.
I think the argument is that, you know, the board decisions need to be a little bit more accurately reflected in the implementation benchmark in order to make some more measurement insights there.
I think it's entirely fair for you to not be accountable for board-level decisions. At the same time, I think when those decisions come up before the board, there's probably going to be more, if we're actually making kind of factor-tilted choices in the portfolio, which it sounds like we are, there's going to be more questioning around that, I think, when that comes up.
Yeah. So I totally get your point, right? And I thought about that as well. So there's the global cap weighted opportunity set, which is, you know, at the highest level is essentially for equities the aggregation of that ACWI plus the Russell 3000, right? And so in the implementation, you're tilting against that global opportunity set, and that comes from, you know, recommendation by us when we do the asset allocation work, recommendation by staff, decision by board. And so you're kind of, you're missing, okay, well, how are we, what's the difference between how we're implementing versus the global opportunity set? And that is what you're missing, but there's other ways to get at that. Over time, you know, you compare yourself to your actuarial assumed rate of return. You compare yourself to risk-free rate plus inflation. You compare yourselves to other plans that are looking at these things similarly. So there's other ways to get to that. And then, you know, we look at the policy index quarter, year to date, year 1-3-5 back for individual years to look at how it's being implemented. So that's kind of the way that I think about it. Don't know if that's helpful or not.
Yeah, I think it's helpful. I think it makes a lot of sense. I just, from my experience here on the board, I think the practice is to kind of take the recommendations as given. There's some questioning, certainly.
Yep.
But, you know, it's in the sense that we're approving that level of detail, sure, the staff shouldn't be accountable for deviations from those manager-level benchmarks. At the same time, there's very much room there going forward for those questions like, hey, you know, it's a couple percent annualized for 3-4 years. Shouldn't we be passive? Yeah, I think that becomes a very legitimate argument the next time something like this is raised.
2 points is a big deal.
And this allows you to focus on that. And this allows you to focus on that question.
Karen, did you have additional questions or comments?
Yes. Sorry, I'm unclear on page 11. I'm unclear on what the differences are between B, C, and D, and why the differences occur.
Mm-hmm.
I think you explained that B is the policy index, so that's what the board determines, targets or goals. And then C is what the manager's benchmarks are. So are we hiring managers that aren't consistent with the board's mandate? Or please explain.
Okay. I'm trying to think of the best way to explain. The usage of each one of these different benchmarks allows you to segregate out the impact that area is having on the difference between the total fund performance and the policy benchmark, right? So it allows you to split that difference into all its component parts. The first part that we're looking at is that benchmark mismatch, right? It's like, how is the portfolio being implemented differently than the way we're measuring it? And that's the part that we want to get rid of. The second level is how are you implementing the portfolio with overweights and underweights to how the managers are expected to be managing. And that's on Tim and his team with tactical asset allocation that are doing. Just using that as a broad term. And then the third measure pulls out how the managers are doing relative to their benchmarks. So those are the biggest components, right? The benchmark mismatch, how you're doing with tactical asset allocation, and how your managers are doing, beating their benchmarks or not. So I guess with that as a starting explanation, maybe you could reframe your question. Because I wasn't quite clear how to respond to your question.
So on page 11, C, passive benchmarks, we describe that as manager benchmarks, that portfolio implemented weights.
Right.
Are those benchmarks that the managers choose for themselves?
In conjunction with us and staff. It's not like they say, hey, here's what we'd like to do, and this is super easy. We say, oh, no, here's how you're managing, and here's what you should be benchmarked against.
So why is that different from B, the policy index?
Oh, so that goes back to the table in the back where the policy index is at the high level of domestic equities, and the managers are implementing at, so, for example, there's more small cap in the implementation. Small cap managers have more assets in the implementation than is weighted in the Russell 3000, which is the policy benchmark.
Thank you.
Does that
make sense?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a suggestion, and Karen, unless you have additional questions that may address any other thoughts you might have. And the suggestion is, I'm not certain, at least for me, that I'm comfortable taking an action today on this. The discussion and the Q&A has been pretty illuminating. In the sense of what we're looking at, on the one hand, it looks straightforward and simple, but on the other hand, it's a little more complicated. Here's my suggestion, and glad to hear input, of course. I would suggest we bring this back, having had this discussion today, which was extremely helpful, and get a written memorandum that sets out primarily two functions. One would be a report and a recommendation that covers the analysis of the retroactivity piece and at least puts some depth and dimension on what that restatement looks like on an annualized basis. And then two, I would suggest we bring back a preferred form of motion to effectuate the action that is desired here in terms of revising the benchmark structure. because I think it's important that we have a detailed, specific written motion that actually is something we can go back and look at, so that we're not fuzzy or unclear about what it is we did or didn't do. And I think that's important just from the standpoint of we as board members come and go, but this needs to be something that's very concrete and understood.
So a clarifying question on that.
Yes.
Would a format that works to address that concern be the table on 14, but with every single resolution with percentages for every time period? Does that make sense?
I think so. I think if you did that snapshot analysis for each of the retro years,
my sense is that
would answer the mail and provide that information. That would make it clear for each of the years what the impact is in terms of what was and what we would now restate it to be. So, yes, I think the short answer to that question is yes.
Okay.
And then the second piece, to me equally as important, is to make sure that the motion is very clear and states exactly what it is that we're adopting for the change, you know, in this policy and what's going to happen annually thereafter. I just think it needs to be clear because, like I say, we're here for the time we're here, and this is a pretty important issue.
So. Yes, sir.
Spell out the methodology and the retroactive. Spell out the methodology on a going forward basis and how that's applied retroactively.
Yes.
Okay.
I can look at the table on 14 and understand what it is we're doing.
Yeah,
I think we all can. But it's making sure that the motion captures what I'm sensing here is a pretty significant change in what we're doing and how we're tracking it. So I think we want to capture that in a discrete written motion that we can consider, amend, and thereafter adopt. So there's no misunderstandings. We all know what we're doing, and we have clear sailing ahead. Is that fair? David.
I'd also like to consider the power of the tool going forward, looking into the future and how we use it. So with the benchmark, we use that as a gauge. Are we getting the returns that we should be getting? Are we going above? Are we getting some alpha out of this? Or are there areas where we need to take a deeper look into to adjust and so forth to bring us to where we should be. So we'll keep monitoring this, the comparison as to what we're doing versus, what the benchmark says. Is it possible to think about what margin of error would be acceptable around the benchmark? I mean, if we're half a point below, or should it be a quarter point or whatever, then that's no big deal. If we're half a point above, then don't get too excited. That's within the margin, right? Is that a reasonable?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole body of practice around active risk management and what tracking error, what you're basically describing, tracking error above or below the benchmark, the volatility around the benchmark, and what's acceptable. We haven't really spent a ton of time with the board on that, but it's something we could look into.
Okay, because I also want to, looking back at adjusting what was reality versus what was noise. But also seeing how we can apply this going forward, how we monitor it, what it means to us, and our whole investment strategy and so forth.
Yeah, I'm thinking that in terms of the go forward and utilizing this methodology, that it's a pretty valuable tool for Tim and his staff, as well as Scott Veris, to help and analytically to determine areas of non-performance or underperformance. It seems like the more, it's a more granular view of the ability to track at a fairly finite level to try to identify, you know, laggards, outperformers, what have you. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's got to be a lot more information than we currently have, I assume. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I think to the extent we go down this path of active risk, it can be helpful because it kind of defines the neighborhood that you expect to be in rather than a fixed point. And if I'm 10 basis points above or behind that, well, you know, what's the context there? Rather than we talk about the asset allocation studies, you talk about these range of outcomes. To the extent we're using more volatile asset classes that track near expanse, and I think that's, you know, that's an interesting conversation. As Scott said, we haven't had that. I think that's an interesting conversation to have on a prospective basis. If we can get into a methodology that allows for clear communication of that around expectations, I don't want to go down the path of here's a bunch of new information that doesn't kind of tie together, so we need to be careful about how we craft the tracking so that it's clear to the trustees and clear to the public that this is in line with expectations versus deviating from expectations, but I'm happy to go down that conversation route.
I'm assuming, as we sit here today, that the expectation that is a shared one is that the FFP structure is what we are looking at as embodying our expectations, what the assumptions are, what the risk-adjusted reward is expected to be at the end of the day. Those, to me, I think are current policies. I hope they are.
Anyway. Yeah.
That's the current case. So whatever we do in this context, it has to be with respect to the current case and using the tool within that. If we need to change that or if we're going to revisit that, fine. But at least the rules of engagement are, as I understand them to be, are the FFP rules of engagement and expectations. This is a tool, if implemented properly, and I expect it can be and will be, provides more information that will allow you to pinpoint and highlight some areas that either are outperforming or need improvement, right?
It refines the implementation.
Yeah. It's not designed to change the implementation, it's to refine it, because the implementation is what we have embraced in FFP until we change that, right? Yes.
Yeah. I actually have a question. Why we're not talking then of changing implementation? Because it seems like we're trying to fix the benchmark that was selected that we're constantly underperforming. So it kind of makes more sense, at least to me, if I don't understand, that it would be better probably to change implementation to measure the benchmark than to measure, to change the benchmark to a lower return on implementation. So why are we talking about that? I understand that you cannot change the past, but at least going forward, why aren't we talking about changing implementation?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, right? So if your implementation isn't meeting up to where your simple benchmark is, why don't you just implement in line with your simple benchmark?
Mm-hmm.
It's a great question. That would have to do with using more passive management in line with the global opportunity set. And largely, the implementation decision on an annual basis, the strategic asset allocation and review that happens on an annual basis, takes into account forecasts of what's going to happen over the next 10 years that aren't necessarily aligned with how the global opportunity set is aligned, right? So the global opportunity set is capitalization weighted. There's more big companies, and you would allocate more money to big companies than you would small companies. And sometimes the forecast is, well, small companies are going to outperform big companies, or emerging markets are going to outperform developed markets. So let's lean into that a little bit differently than just the way that the global opportunity set is presenting itself. So it's just an exercise of forecasting, thinking where you want to take overweights or underweights relative to that global opportunity set. And, you know, an easy way to do it would be, hey, let's go all passive and let's just invest in line with the global opportunity set, because that's the way the market right now thinks that you ought to invest. And some people do it that way. this board and staff and Verus and most other institutional investors choose to deviate a little bit from that. So that's the reason.
Any other thoughts or comments on this? Yes, Dan.
Thank you. Question back on 14, just wanted to get clarification. The very first category in domestic equity, we list as the Russell 1000 index and no delineation into growth or value on the 10%. And then we do take a subset of the value on 3%.
So that is because it's implemented in an index.
So we are taking the full...
That is passively implemented.
The Russell 1000 index, and then we just take the value subset of 3%,
yeah,
as opposed to where we're splitting the hairs on the rest.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I'm not seeing any other hands or lights on. So is the direction sufficient in terms of what
yes
was outlined? I mean, we can refine it or talk about it. I just...
Yep. I think we have good marching orders. We'll see if we come back and you deem that we have met them satisfactorily.
All right. Well, that's excellent. So thank you. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you all. Good questions. Good discussion. All right.